So this afternoon, I thought we would continue our conversation on sin, since no doubt you've been thinking about it, maybe even exercising it a bit. Given our talk last night, our thinking together, what does that say to you? What do you draw from that? Or how does it kindle your thinking about living in a world where we often see our brothers and sisters, we often see our institutions miss the mark? What kind of, again, keeping in mind this notion of the Orthodox mind, what are you invited to? What is your stance invited to be in light of that? What does our conversation and the stance in the face of sin say to you about living in a world that also manifests aspects of God's kingdom? And manifests it often, at least in a formal way, outside of what most people would think the church to be. And the third one on my plate is, what does the Orthodox stance suggest to you about moralism? What does it suggest to you about some of these demanding issues of our day, that a few of which we talked about yesterday, and we can continue that if you wish, but I'll put a couple others on the table for you. What does it say to you about the issues of wealth and poverty in our world, about caring for creation, about the preoccupation with development and progress? What does it say about propaganda and truth-telling? About the art of the possible, politics, and Orthodox aspiration? So let me just throw one other item onto the plate. And then I'd like to listen to what you would like to think about out loud. William Blake, the great and quite crazy poet, once noted that what was unique about Christianity in all the great religions of the world is that it was a religion which did not have truth at its center, did not have purity at its center, did not have perfection at its center, but rather, unlike any other faith in the world, it had forgiveness at its center. Forgiveness. Which leads me to suggest that Christianity is not a moral religion. There are moral religions, but Christianity isn't one of them. It's a way of transformation. So, you may see it differently. So,
you just made me think of the ending of Till We Have Faces, C.S. Lewis. Are the gods not just? Good heavens, child, no. What would become of us if they were?
Yeah.
And you too shall be Psyche.
Yeah. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I don't know. how many people have read Till We Have Faces?
Yeah, just give us, put us in the landscape and elaborate on it a little bit.
Well, without going into ridiculous detail, at the very end of the book, there's a bit of a twist, and the main character, who her whole life has thought of herself a certain way, finds that she's in a process of transformation. Is that subtle enough? I don't want to give it away, because it's actually really awesome.
Oh, give it away.
No, I don't want to.
None of these people are going to read it anyway.
You should. It's the best thing you ever wrote. Sorry. It seems like what you're saying about it being not moralistic, but more transformative. Is that where you're going with it? It just makes me think of that. At that ending where the whole point of all these things that she thought what she was doing for some other reason are for something else entirely, and it's for her to change. I'm butchering it, you should say it.
So Lewis understood that. What are moral systems? Do you have some sense of what they are?
An attempt to make things run smoothly?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's one of the main things that they do? How do they structure that in order to try and encourage things to run smoothly and not get out of hand?
Guilt.
So moral systems inherently use the power of positive guilt.
And I think they also cut very black and white lines around this.
Uh-huh.
The fear of punishment.
You know, there are some scholars that suggest that moral systems are always born out of tribal considerations. Who's fully human and who isn't? Out of class considerations. Who's part of my world and who isn't? Sometimes out of guild situations and professional situations. We have professional moral codes. And these are all, you know, they're all useful. And they're all, in some sense, I suppose, worthy for what they are saying to the inside. But of their very nature, they also are saying, they also are drawing a boundary around those who are inside the circle. And that means there are people outside that circle. It also means that when you're inside that circle, you may do something, or it may come about that you actually excommunicate yourself. You place yourself outside. You're no longer part of it. So, moral systems, in a sense, are concerned with missing the mark as well. It's just that they define the mark differently. In the Bible, the mark is life. In moral systems, the mark is whatever the moral system idealizes. So it's not that what it idealizes isn't good. It's too small for life. That's why Pelican, this comment that I gave to you yesterday, Jesus Christ is never less than a moralist, and is always more than a moralist. He forgives as no moralist can, and he makes a requirement far greater than any moralist would. Because the requirement is that you keep your eye on the ball, which isn't the ideals of a moral system. It is the vitality of life and how life is held together by God's grace. So often it seems to me we get a little bound up. This is one of the challenges, I think, of the religious communities often in our part of the world. That's okay. We like it here. We sometimes can replace the living faith with a set of moral absolutes or a set of or a kind of moral system. Do you see that as a problem or an issue? Or is this just something that I've been preoccupied with and none of you see?
I liked the Orthodox perspective on sin because it bores more about a way of life that allows you to be fully human and to experience true, full life.
Two stories. Little stories. The first one from the Gospels. And it builds on what it's the other side of the issue, it seems to me, from what you were pointing to, or another side of the issue. The rich young man comes to Jesus by night. Jesus has a reputation. He's kind of a crazy rabbi. He's understood to be a slightly crazy rabbi. This is not unusual. He's a kind of hasid. A rabbi who's a little bit on the margins of things. So the rich young ruler, who's obviously troubled by something, comes by night. And what does he say to him? He says, "Master, Rabbi, I have lived the whole of the law. I have done it all." This is not bragging, I don't think. This is a description. And then he says, "But I am still empty." So that's the other side of it. The tragedy of having a mind which thinks that there is a formula that gives you the vitality of life. There can be many such formulas. Moral systems are one, but we have a few in our society that are just enormously powerful, which aren't moral systems in the strict sense, but they're formulas for life. So Jesus also saw that there's a kind of unfolding tragedy in the lives of some people who have thought that the moral system, as good as it is, the moral system is at its very best a pathway to the fullness of life. And it's not a pathway with walls around it. So my second little story. I was in Alaska. God, it's a long time ago. It was 1988. Because it was the millennium of the conversion of Kievan Rus. And I was invited up there by the Alaska Historical Society to give a couple lectures on Orthodoxy, because it was the anniversary of the conversion of Kievan Rus. And as you know, Orthodoxy in North America, outside of a boat that capsized in Texas or Florida a few hundred years ago, was first served, the liturgy was first served here. I like to say it was served in Aleut. It's not quite true, but it's a nice historical fancy, by Russian monks on the Aleutian chain. So Alaska had an interest in it. So I went up there. I stayed in the bishop's house, and the bishop was away. There was a clergyman from the sort of school that the OCA has at, I guess it's on Spruce Island, isn't it? Or Kodiak, yeah. And the priest who ran that school was there, lovely man from the lower 48. We spent a nice evening in conversation. And then in the morning, we walked down from the bishop's house to the center of Sitka. Sitka was built by my ancestors, by a bunch of Scandinavians who came with the Russian All-American Company. They were traders, and my ancestors were carpenters. So it's got this lovely look to it that I was so familiar with. I could almost smell my father's wood shop walking down the street. And in the center, the street comes up from the harbor, and in the center, it goes around the church that was built a couple hundred years ago when they first came. So it was raining. And of course, this is a maritime town, and it smelled like Stavanger, Norway, where my father grew up. And so I was feeling a little nostalgic as we walked out. And we turned the corner to face the church, and it's like 7 in the morning. And we take a few steps, and suddenly we hear an enormous cry, a wail, just a wail. And just before that, I'd asked the priest about what he was doing, and he talked about the program for dealing with alcoholism. That alcoholism was a huge problem, and they were trying to deal with it. So he was speaking about that. We turned to look, and about 2 blocks away, we could see, like close to the water, a tall woman, and she obviously was in great distress. She was just wailing. And the priest said to me, "Ah, David, this is what I mean. You know, we have this terrible problem with alcoholism. It's awful." And he turned around to walk towards the church. I hesitated a little. I felt uncomfortable by this, but I turned to walk to the church. We got to the church. He went inside. I went inside with him, and as soon as he had disappeared, I went back outside to see if I could find him. I walked around for about 40 minutes, couldn't find him. So I came back. The liturgy began, and it was the reading for this day. So the priest came out on the ambo with his, he was a mitre priest, with his mitre off, and he read the gospel text for this day. And a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, fell among thieves, and the priest and the Levite walked by on the other side. Finished the gospel reading, turned around, laid the gospel book on the holy table, came around and said, "I am that priest. I have served in Alaska for 40 years, and only today do I realize I am that priest. And I beg your forgiveness. I have thought it was about alcoholism. And so I never bent down on the other side." Bang, that's it. The door opens. In she walks. In she walks. Sobbing. There's like 100 people there. They turned to her. I had a sense that they knew who she was. And it's true. She appeared to have been drinking. Made me wonder this morning how you got the wine in here for communion. The service continues. And she speaks to somebody. And they go up through the deacon door. And she walks over to the deacon door, just down from it. And out comes the priest. Comes down the steps, puts his arms around her, and they saw together. They saw and saw and saw. 2 distinct sorrows. And she talks to him. As the service continues, one of the wonderful things about Orthodoxy, isn't it? That it really is a mosaic. That many things can go on at the same time. It's a kind of icon of the spiritual life. Many things go on at the same time. The spiritual life is never one-dimensional. It's never just occurring in one register. It's never just occurring in one place. They must have been there for half an hour or so. I was sitting not far away. And then he returns and she sits down for a while. And then the time of communion comes. And I say to myself, oh my, now what's going to happen? I have never been big on petitionary prayer. It's just sort of who I am. I figure that anything I would ask God would be, you know, a good deal less than what's appropriate. And the things I ought to ask are too hard to ask. Because I don't want to hear them. In any case, people come towards the chalice, and she gets up and joins the line. And I think to myself, what is this going to mean? Will they give her communion? What will happen? So I begin to pray, oh, please, give her communion. I mean, I just hear that wail, you know. Tears are still rolling down her cheeks. She's still a little uneasy on her legs. She comes. They give her communion. I know nothing about her history. I don't know if she's Orthodox or not. I made assumptions. They gave her communion. They saw her as part of the table. When I walk back with the priest after the end of the liturgy, he says to me, at 3:00 in the morning, they were having a party on a boat, fishing boat, docked in the harbor. And her husband of 20 years fell overboard and drowned. What we heard wasn't alcohol. There was that. But what we heard was the wail of despair. So it's always, I mean, that moment to me sort of captured what can so easily happen to us in the moral register. Alcohol isn't a huge problem. It needs to be pushed back. All of that's the case. But when we turn towards the church and away from her, we made a moral turn. We didn't walk that road, as Father Matthew said this morning, quoting Searle, down as Christ walked the road down. That's faith. That's the turn of transformation. That's the turn that is done in the hope that one can pull life from death. And it seems to me that with the understanding of sin that so many of you talk so eloquently about, that at least one dimension of the stance, the posture of the Orthodox mind, is to incline us to turn not towards the church through our moral righteousness, but to turn towards the wail of the human heart in the midst of its struggle and agony.
How do you deal with people, and I've encountered people over years, it's illustrated by a newspaper story I read about a lady in North Bamford, and she was an alcoholic, and she wouldn't stop, and she was always drinking and driving, and she had, in the course of her several years, killed 5 people drinking and driving. And when she was in court, she was wailing, and she was screaming, and she was so unhappy because she had killed 1 more person. But every once in a while you meet someone and they're just completely heartbroken and torn up.
Sure.
And then 5 minutes later they go out and they do exactly the same thing.
Sure.
It's just, how on earth would you even approach someone like that? Because, I mean, even myself, sometimes like, I gotta get really upset. I do something and then 5 minutes later I'll do exactly the same thing.
So what do you think? What's your sense? Given what we've talked about, given your understanding of how the Orthodox spiritual life is shaped, what is your sense of how to respond to that?
Well, part of me thinks that they put themselves at a place where only they can help themselves,
uh-huh.
And I can only put up my shoulders and, you know, shrug because I'm limited to helping in any real meaningful way. I mean, that's just my impression. I don't know what I can do. I mean, to help them would mean to, I don't know, lock them up or over. I mean, if someone's drinking and driving and killing people, you'd have to lock them up so it wouldn't harm people. But
the state is a moral system.
But if you can't, but if it's not something like that, if it's something where they're,
right,
they're only hurting themselves,
right?
I almost feel like your hands are tied, you can't do anything about it. Maybe, well, of course you can pray for them. I suppose that's the last thing you can do.
Now, my friend Arlette Zink made friendship with Omar Khayyam because, from her perspective, Omar Khayyam was laid at her feet. Now, this woman is an example that you mentioned, but I don't get the sense from what you've said that she was laid at your feet.
No.
It's a newspaper story.
There are thousands of people I've known, or in a small way,
sure,
lots of people are like that. You know, you just keep doing the same thing over and over.
Right. But if you see that in someone who has been laid at your feet, someone who you know, someone who you have a relationship with, or where that relationship is, or the possibility of it is laid on your heart. In that case, what do you think the Orthodox spiritual life calls you to do?
I think the best thing is to do the prayer, because I know sometimes it's even worse to comfort them, because if you comfort them, I mean, it sounds really harsh, but if you comfort them, they have no, it doesn't lead to any self-reflection on their part, and they'll even get even worse.
And it was this moment of grace that allowed them to kind of deal with some of these things in his life. But so like so much time without results, just love, and our time and our presence. I think that's we're so bad at it. I'm so bad at that. I'm so impatient, you know.
Makes me think a little bit of the story of Jesus with the woman caught in adultery. And at least how I take the story, it seems like this is a woman that this is her lifestyle of, you know, just promiscuity or whatever, and just the how few words Jesus speaks to her, just go and sin no more, you know, and almost knowing like you'll be back in the same thing. Almost, I don't know, like that's kind of the initial thoughts I have with that story. And, you know, Jesus doesn't give some sort of anecdote. Okay, when you find someone like this, then yeah, you don't throw a stone, but you walk, I don't know, there isn't really a step-by-step, this is how you make someone stop sinning, whatever it is.
Were there any other sinners in that story?
Mm-hmm. Of course, everyone that didn't throw a stone, besides Christ.
Because they were accusers, huh? I mean, I've often wondered with that narrative. The degree to which Jesus Well, let me back up. I mean, it's a really interesting example in light of at least another way of thinking about the Orthodox mindset. So here this woman's been accused, and the men have brought her. So the first thing that we hear is silence. I think that's a real lesson. Jesus does not respond. He does not respond to the accusation. He doesn't take the accusation on board, and he doesn't deny the accusation. He is silent. He creates this landscape of quiet. He also, and if you're interested, René Girard, the great French anthropologist, has written an extraordinary book about this matter. He's really probably the world's greatest scholar on scapegoating, on scapegoat theory. But he has written a book called I Saw Satan Fall Like Lightning, which is a quote from Jesus Christ, in which he does a kind of analysis of this story as well. And he points out that how weighty this silence is. When you are in the context of accusation, or what I prefer to call the context of the two codependent twins. I'll accuse you from this side, I'll accuse you from this side. You know, that kind of ideological rigidness. Or, to put it another way, when you're in a moral context. So, then what does Jesus do? There's this lengthy silence, and then he bends down, and he writes in the dust. Which, by the way, is the only evidence we have that Jesus knew how to write. Because he never, you know, unlike the Apostle Paul, he never sent any letters. Pardon?
Well, he read the scriptures too, so he probably knew how to write.
Well, that's a question. Did he really read them, or was he just reciting? So then he stands up. And René Girard says he doesn't look at them. He casts his eyes away. Because, you know, looking at people can also be confrontational, especially when they're angry. If you look at somebody who's angry, you know, whether you are or not, it can be read that way. So, and this is a kind of Near Eastern thing as well, in Near Eastern culture. But he looks away. And then finally he speaks those words. Those simple, direct words. And I've always seen him move closer to her at that point. In fact, I've always seen him put his arm around her at that point. There's an extraordinary painting by Cranach the Elder, who converted to Lutheranism, of this incident, where you see the men crowded around. They look like men, but they also look like animals, because the situation of accusation is one which brings out the animal passion. And then he speaks those words, he who is without sin. What is that doing? I mean, it's so curious to me how we have these hierarchy of sins. Like the last time in our lovely little parish in Edmonton, St. Herman's, that I walked by a group of men who were having a little conversation. It's the last one that occurred. It was a few years ago. a little conversation about their concerns about gay marriage and homosexuality. I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh God, get over it. But one of them was quoting this text that is often invoked about stoning. So I stopped. And I put my arms around him and I said, are you still eating BLTs? They thought, what are you talking about? You know, they're having a serious conversation. I said, are you still eating BLTs? I can be insistent. You wouldn't know that. You still eat bacon for breakfast? Yeah, of course I'm eating bacon. What are you talking about? I said, look, I will discuss this issue of homosexuality with you, but only after you stop eating bacon, because I have to stone you right now. You think you can eat bacon and talk about this, given the Jewish law that you think you're invoking? So, it is an awful thing to assume what constitutes sin. It is an awful thing to assume, except for ourselves, when we hear our own conscience, the prophet in our own heart, speaking to us about how we've missed the mark. So I suggest to you, what we call homosexuality is not sin. Sin is missing the mark. If someone is born into the world with the enormous desire to love, that love is manifested in a variety of ways. So I suggest to you that if you look at the human being that comes into the world, our little baby here. If you look at all that has gone in to her being, to the baby's being, and all the possibilities that exist for how this baby will be, blue eyes, green eyes, lots of hair, no hair, squiggly ears, straight ears. It goes on and on and on. The assumption that seems to kick around in some places that one of the most complex dimensions of our nature, which is the sexual dimension of our nature, the assumption that that somehow is fixed, that that isn't complex, that different things don't occur, and they occur all the time. There, thank you. That would be wonderful. Amen. That was what she was saying. Did you catch it? So let me suggest this to you, since this issue has come up a few times. The inclination of any one of us to have natural affection for the opposite sex, or have natural affection for someone who looks like us, exists, I think, quite clearly on a bell curve. My sin tends to be that I'm a flaming heterosexual. You know, I can be overly easily attracted to women. That's an area of my life that is an area of struggle. It should not surprise me that there are men and women born into the world who are on the other end, and their area of struggle is the same as mine. Their area of struggle is the same as mine. It's not being gay. It's not, the struggle is imagining you can be something you can't be. Imagining you can love all the women in the world. Imagining that you are somehow or other not focused and attentive and able to live your life out with integrity in deep human relationship. The problem is deep human relationship. That is our share. People are not born with sins, no matter how they are born, no matter what their sexual orientation is. Now, this is my position, and I'm happy to have you come back on. You know, in the Orthodox Church, we have had a kind of long institutional way of resolving this issue. It's called monasteries. Monasteries have many purposes. This is also one of their purposes. Monasteries have been places where men and women can go who have particular struggles in this area of their life, and who can find a safe place where they can work those struggles out. Now, my view is that the church marries people based on the profound sense of the meaning of gender difference as part of its symbol system. The only reason we speak of God as male isn't because any of us believe God is male. Clearly, God is not male. But that's the way our mind and our languages work for a purpose. What's the purpose? It's to speak of the whole world as feminine. The whole world as the beloved. That's the purpose. God is our lover. And I am as much a woman as you, who are women, in those terms, if you want to think of it that way, which is the way in which most cultures have shaped these matters. So I want to suggest to you that there is no condition that a human being can be born with or into, which is sin. And all human beings are born with different predilections. Mine are not like yours, yours are not like mine. And all those predilections have the possibility of being acted on, lived out in sinful ways. No different than any others. If we want to have a hierarchy of sin in any way, at the top of the hierarchy is one that I've exercised a great deal. It's called pride. And certainly, in the debate about gay marriage in our society, I must admit, I kept saying, you know, what are you guys talking about? What about pride? But there is a fundamental problem in the whole debate, which was it was assuming something that is, I think, untrue. If somebody is born with the inclination to be attracted to the same sex, they're born with the inclination to be attracted to the same sex. That's not a sin. It's the way they are. And the way they are is the way they are. Moving from that to the point of saying, should the church marry them, is another story. Moving from that to saying, should the church bless their marriage, which is all the church does anyways. The church doesn't marry anybody. They marry each other. That, I think, is up for debate. How that would be done, I don't know. But it's not an issue that interests me a lot. But should the state marry them? In my judgment, probably, in that sense, the state is ahead of the church. But the state does different things than the church, so I'm not really inclined to put it ahead. I'm more inclined to say, well, the state can do many things the church doesn't do. The church needs to do what it can do well, and so does the state. But my own sense is the state ought to be congratulated on this. And if for no other reason, it actually diminishes gay culture. It is no longer necessary for gay people to see themselves as marginalized. And that is a blessing. Or at least it seems to me it is. It lessens enmity. Or is there something to be afraid of here that I don't see?
You sort of skipped from...
What do you think?
The natural, the inclination someone has towards same-sex attraction,
yeah,
to marriage. But what about behavior? So if someone is born with those inclinations...
We are all called to chastity. We are all called to asceticism. We are all called to fidelity. We're all called to live out our relationships with the kind of aspiration that we see going on there. Now, I assume what you mean is, given what I've said, do I see it as somehow morally necessary for people who are gay to live out their life as celibate monks, monastics? Do I see it as morally necessary for heterosexuals who have had more than one sexual relationship in their life to live out their life as celibate monastics? What's the difference? I can suggest one difference. One difference is that we live in a tradition that has really seen the loving of a man and a woman for each other as a great symbol of the love of God for the church, and as a spiritual insight into what it means to give yourself to another and to be fulfilled by another. And I treasure that. I think that's such a gift. But I have also come to appreciate that we need, and this I would suggest to you, I think is part of the Orthodox mind, we need to appreciate how the church speaks to us of aspiration. So the idea that one would come to love another and that their love would grow and it would be the only love of their life. It would be the only love they ever even imagined they had. And the only love of their life, and they would die in each other's arms together. That's an aspiration, and it's beautiful and it's wonderful.
You mean something like, but God honors the intent?
But when it gets turned into a privileged pattern, it becomes a problem. That's why Christianity has at its heart a much more generous understanding than that. So my sense is that the Orthodox mind, what I learned from the church fathers and spiritual mothers, is that we can hold more than one thing together at a time. We don't have to sacrifice that aspiration and everything it speaks about and its great gift. We don't have to let go of that in order to understand that the vast majority of human beings in the world have not had the grace. They have had the sin. They have missed the mark. All kinds of ways that hasn't been how life has unfolded.
Yeah.
You know, Orthodoxy, unlike Roman Catholicism, has two rituals for marriage. There is a rite for second marriages. Why? And why is it shaped the way it is? Because Orthodoxy has understood better than any other of the Christian traditions, it seems to me, the mystery of death. Not just dying, but of death. That in fact, sometimes in our life, we experience death. And Orthodoxy, as I think, proclaimed with sharpness that is so amazing, that we are baptized into Christ's death. So we know that death itself is not the conqueror. He has conquered death by death. And we can await the resurrection, the other side of our deaths. So, my sense is, and again, I'm not making this argument as a theological argument on behalf of, you know, from the church's perspective. But I extrapolate it from that. That if two human beings actually love each other, I would hope that I would bless that love. Because there isn't enough love in the world. There's been a dimension of gay male culture which has been very predatory. And I think, as our friend and colleague here has talked about yesterday in such a poignant way, because of the way the conversation around this matter was shaped over the last 20 years in Canada, that issue was never even talked about, or hardly talked about. And I've had someone in my family who's been the subject of predatory gay culture. And that was not easy, because it was abusive. But it wouldn't have been any less abusive if it had been heterosexual. The point is, it was abusive. The point, it was wrong. The point, it was colonizing.
David, I'm going to drop me in between my sure. And say, this is the first time in these talks that I feel like you've offered a non-compassionate response to an issue.
Huh.
I guess for me, I feel like compassion has to invite people to recognize that there is brokenness related to their whole being, including their sexuality, and that every time a person will take up their cross, it will bear fruit. And so for me, I don't have any difficulty recognizing the tragedy and the difficulty of sexual brokenness in heterosexual persons.
Sure.
I have an 11-year-old son. I have a fiancé with whom I've not been chased. This is sin and its brokenness. Yeah. I would find it very sad if my priest didn't continue to tell me, okay, repent, strive for the goal, strive to create your sexuality within the context of a blessed marriage between a man and a woman, which is procreative, it brings about life, it's contained within God, it's not made a mistake, I don't think, created this agenda. And I guess you've entered in an assumption, I think subtly, we have to assume that a person is born with same-sex attraction. But it's still a matter of debate. And I know what it is to be born with something over and against having brokenness written into it. I mean, people are born with alcoholism in that sense. We're born with inclinations toward all sorts of sin, toward lust after money, towards desire for power. We're born with tendencies towards sin. What's fruitful in the Christian is entering into the process of repentance and picking up your cross, which always bears fruit. And I don't want to take a cross away from the person who starts with same-sex attraction. I want to say, I understand, every time you would give in and fall in this for decades, I will walk with you. But I don't want to take away the opportunity for them to continue to pick up that cross, recognize the cross, and engage in repentance, which is just what a heterosexual person's broken sexuality will do too. And I feel like I don't want to take that away. So it feels to me like your option, if I'm understanding you correctly, which is we should stop falling into same-sex sexual acts and sin. It seems like to me that would be a non-compassionate response. Because it takes away the opportunity of repentance. It takes the cross away from you and the chance to bear the fruit of the cross.
Well spoken. What do you think?
Mark, what if it was you, and the church was denying you the opportunity to ever be in an intimate relationship with anyone?
I would probably fail my whole life long.
Like, I feel like that cross is too big. Like, when I was 11 years old, a girl that we went to church with came out to me that she was gay. And I was 11, and like super sheltered, so I didn't even really understand. And I probably said some really stupid things to her. But I remember thinking, my desire to be in an intimate, loving relationship and to share my life completely and wholly with another person is so strong. And what we're telling her is that she has to walk. She has to be alone for the rest of her life. If she wants to do the right thing, she has to carry her cross and be alone for the rest of her life.
There are cases of people with same-sex attraction who engage at a level of loving kindness. It was, Cornelius was telling me as someone, Michelle was telling me as someone. So these are people who have, at the sexual level, an attraction to the same sex, but they are able to engage in a family life and a sexual life. Is it diminished because of their suffering? Do they have less of the sexual feelings that a man or a woman would have? Or that they would have? Yes, but they engage in these. They have families and they thank God for it and they consider that part of their struggles. They engage in that. And it's diminished the fact that I, through my life, will probably share in what David has shared in terms of sin, that I'll be married to one woman and I'll constantly look at that woman and look at that woman and look at that one. That's going to diminish my sexual life with my wife too. And it's my struggle. But it doesn't give me... For me, I feel like then that's my struggle. I've just decided to find this struggle. I don't believe that monasteries is the only answer. And just because I've met enough people who say, I have the same sense of attraction, it has not gone away. Sure. And I have a family. Here's my wife and my three children. Sure. And I don't like when that's
done through force. I know that. Yeah.
I don't like when that's done through force or like, you know, there's people that can force themselves to get married. But there are other people that say this is a life-giving relationship. Sure. I thank God for this woman, even though I'm attracted to men. It's easy.
I'm not saying I have a solution. I feel like that is the biggest cross I can imagine.
It is for me too, and I don't have a word of judgment to say for those people, my beloved friends, who are homosexual and practicing.
Can I just interject, like, in this very feeling and empathetic conversation that you guys are both having? I'm almost reluctant to bring this up, but there's something a little bit inconsistent to what I understand about the Orthodox mind in what Mark is offering. And it's not that I don't understand the value of restraint. It's just because I think that's actually paramount to any real loving relationship. And but it's hard for me to imagine a full marital relationship in which sexual attraction is absent or constantly decategorized. So while you may, you know, as I think we all who get married would, continue to be attracted to other people randomly throughout the day or throughout the month based on whatever strange things happen to us that cause us to be attracted, but those things don't matter. They're just kind of ephemera. And the person that we go home to, is that's the important person. And we don't act on these other impulses. But that person, we would be attracted to other women or other men, and then our husband or wife is of that gender, right? So with the way in which Orthodoxy embraces the total person, there's something to me that seems a little bit inconsistent about somehow shelving this sexuality bit. Like, you can embrace all of this in marriage, and then the sexuality bit, that's just going to have to be divided in this peculiar way. Like, so it just, yeah.
I actually don't understand. Divided, like, I guess.
So that you can have this complete relationship with your, and I think Michelle was sharing about that Mormon man who was gay, but then had a wife and kids, and has what he describes, or they together describe, as being a sexually healthy relationship. I have no idea what that means. On average, apparently, it means 3 to 5 times a week. But presumably that they both partake and satisfy each other. And it's hard for me to imagine like a realized sexuality, one which is, as we think of it in Orthodox, like if Orthodox mind embraces, and I'm sorry, this is the other thing that's making this linguistically awkward, is you say Orthodox mind, I guess I mean Orthodox person. So the whole of the person in which they experienced, in which they are incapable of experiencing a generalized attraction. And I'm not sure it's possible, given the way we socially construct attraction and gender, that we can have, I am attracted to this woman, but to no other woman. And all the ephemera that I see around me, those times that don't really matter that I'm going to reject, the rest of those are men. So that seems like a very inconsistent exercise of sexuality. And I understand that, you know, when you have sex, like, the act can happen without even that much attraction. Like, you can, the physical stimuli kick into, and it can happen, you know. But it doesn't then mean that having committed that act, that is a fulfilled sexuality. It doesn't mean that there's, you know, I'm sorry, the full attraction, I guess. Maybe not being very articulate about that.
But when it comes to a marriage, like for any relationship, when you talk about the fullness, nobody has that fullness because we are all broken. So maybe it's not like the couple you were talking with, Josh Weaver's name. When the reason his wife agreed to marry him is they were really good friends. He had come out to her before basically anybody else, but said, you know, because of my Mormon background, being married to a woman, having a family is so important to me, that's more important to me than having the most fulfilling sexual relationship I can have. And she came to the place of realizing, you know, he's one of my best friends. I wish I could marry someone just like him who was straight. And I'm never going to find that. Because whoever you marry, there's going to be something you wish was different. There's going to be a way that you don't relate as well as you could.
But you know what, though? Like, with marriage relationships, and I think this is a part of the problem that we understand marriage, we put such a burden on this other person. Mm-hmm. That person has to be all of these things. Mm-hmm. Whereas we used to live in a much more, you know, connected kind of society. Maybe I'm being nostalgic mm-hmm. for something that I don't even know. But I imagine that when we had larger extended family networks, that, you know what, it's okay if, you know, your husband doesn't share the same taste in music as you, because guess what, your aunt does, and she's right in the room next door or whatever, something like that. But you cannot have realized sexuality anywhere else except for in your marriage relationship, according to Orthodoxy. So on that note, you and your partner have to be together on that, at least. You know what I mean? So I can accept that for other parts of the human person. but I'm not sure about sexuality.
Could we have... Can you speak a little bit here first? We'll come back to you in a minute.
Marriage isn't about sex. That is not why you get married, so that you can have sex.
Fair enough, but it's part of who we are.
It is part of who you are, and it's a good part of who you are.
But it's not all that we are.
It is not all that we are. And, like, Anna and I can speak to... Our parents have the best marriage I have ever seen. Ever.
Not that we're biased.
But I kind of... Like, it was so amazing, and it was so loving, and they did not fight. They communicated so well together. And to have something like that, I would be so blessed. But they met when they were 35 and 37. Mm-hmm. They were engaged in 3 months, and they got married in 6 months. They did not know a lot about each other. What they knew about each other, they learned from the people who knew them. And they both said, well, I trust God. I believe that God will bless this marriage. And I trust the people around me who know these people.
And there was, brought us together.
And who brought us together. And they chose to enter into a marriage, and it was a choice. They were not in love. There was not even a great deal of sexual attraction. But they chose it.
Isn't that something?
Because
that's
they
terrific
wanted,
to hear you say that.
They wanted a marriage. They
yeah.
A family.
And it
yeah.
was the most beautiful relationship.
Interesting.
And my father said, just something that I love. One of his cousins told us this after, at his funeral. He said, I once asked your father when he fell in love with your mother, and he said, well, about right after I asked her to marry me.
I'm sorry, when?
Right after I asked her to marry me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just on some point here, potential speaker talks and sex and so on. Last Saturday, Becky had a conference on a Christian response to homosexuality. Yeah. I thought it was by and large very well presented by a Chinese American who was a gay man. He would still say he's attracted to two men, but he's living a chaste life and not involved in the gay lifestyle as he was. But on the point of marriage, that in his experience and knowing about other queer people, you know, he's saying, you know, marriage is, I guess, especially for, you know, queer Christians, you know, someone that also gender, it really is a gift of God. You know, that it's really, they're being called to marry one person, you know, so someone, as gay say, isn't being called to love all women. Again, just one specific person, and that, you know, through the grace of God, you know, it's a gift of God, and it does work out, you know, that both parties are created and understand what's happening. So I think, even with your understanding, I think your point is sort of not relevant in the sense of how can a gay man love a straight woman kind of thing, or what you're doing.
I think, like, Marsh's point still stands, like, regardless of how you specifically choose to. Like, any of us who's know about our sexuality, like, isn't there still, like, an ideal sort of a sexuality that we're not, none of us are up to?
We're not what?
None of us will live up to. And we should still seek to repent and to take up, I like how you phrase it, to take up the cause. It's not just, like, doing the right thing. It's, in your thoughts, and so I don't know. I think that your point still stands, like, regardless of all these, like, convoluted, like, situations that you may face.
I guess it's more to what David was saying, not having a hierarchy of sin. Mm-hmm. Is a heterosexual person in a marriage to only have that relationship with a wife different from someone who is homosexual or anywhere in between?
Or just a single person who faces the possibility of maybe being single and chaste forever, and not necessarily monastic, but just it's never worked out or whatever.
Well, there are people that have a gift for that. Whether they become monastics or not, they have a gift for it. It's a rare gift.
But some people are forced into it. Like, I'm 33 now. Like, I had a son 11 years ago, and that was a single relationship. And then I remained chaste until 33. If I had not met Shane, not my fiance, my intention was to remain chaste until I met my wife, because I knew my sexuality was rightly expressed in that context. So I have inclinations, I have attractions, I have interests in others, but I choose not to express that, and I trust that God will provide. And I feel like that's...
And God has.
And God has provided, but there was plenty enough time where I thought, well, maybe God will provide the struggle of remaining single for my life. So that I didn't feel a calling to monasticism. I wasn't choosing that, but I was waiting for a wife.
I think, well, I've heard a good book recently. I would recommend it to anyone who is interested in it. It's by an evangelical man. His name is Wesley Hill. It's called Washed and Waiting. It's about him being a homosexual, would never, ever felt any inclination of attraction to a woman. But he had made the decision to stay chaste for his life. You know, obviously, since he's in evangelical, he wouldn't be a monk. But he has a lot of good insights. He has a lot of good insights.
Yeah.
And he examines, within his book, two people that gave him a lot of inspiration, which was Gerard Manley Hopkins and Henry Nguyen. And he goes quite thoroughly into their lives as he researched them. And
they both had struggles like this.
They both had struggles like this. And I think it's important to keep those examples, because for us especially, we might have way more examples than Henri Nguyen or Gerard Manley Hopkins, because we have all these saints. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, none of us will really live up to it, but it's not true, because there are all these examples of the saints. You can find a saint that struggled with anything, and in the end overcame it. It's really, and the stories are true. It's amazing.
And now I'm certainly such an example that we know quite a lot about, because of all of his writings, and his struggle became so surfaced so much towards the end of his life. Others want to dip in on this?
I just wanted to say, like, one thought that came to my mind, even... even within a marriage relationship, I think, you know, as healthy as you can get it in a sexual relationship, I think there's still many, many ways to miss the mark. You know, self-pleasure, whatever, you know, things like that. And so this mark that we talk about is so terribly narrow. The fact is that we'll never actually hit it. And of course, we do everything we can to do what we understand is right and good. And, but in reality, it's none of us will ever. I mean, we all know that. So that was just one thought that came.
I have a monk friend who's very fond of saying that marriage is in many ways a superior condition to monasticism. It, of course, also is a form of monasticism. But the reason he says it is that, in his view, in marriage, you are constantly in a relationship where your ego, where your habits, where your inclinations are actually present to another human being. And so marriage, I mean, I love this orthodox understanding of the purpose of marriage, that it is really where two people covenant together to help each other work out their salvation. And it is intense for that reason. It is so, it has the potential of being so intense. And I don't mean intense in the sense of sparking. I mean it only in the sense that it's constant. And so the possibility of actually coming to understand yourself, getting to the bottom of things, is far greater than when you live, as many monastics do, in larger communities, which are also hothouses, of course, but where you can kind of spread around your neurosis. But in marriage, of course, it is possible for marriages to be very neurotic too. But in marriage, often, the possibilities of actually coming to that self-understanding over time are forced. So it says something to us of the enormous value of people who covenant together with each other to work out their salvation. And of course, the possibility of doing that in the context of the church as well, with its extraordinary insight and knowledge and language for these matters, is enhanced enormously. Well, thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate what you've all said and how demanding this is. It shan't be the last time to talk about it.